boring and technical. It's something that was a little bit off the beaten path. And what I've been doing for the past, well, for the past 6 months, absolutely nothing technical, was I quit my job in January. It's been, I don't mean about this thing, guys. It's been heaven since then. But for the past 2 years, my role at Morgan Stanley was a little bit complicated. I did some technical things, but I also involved a lot of stuff on the management side and trying to deal with how to think about open source. And I've given some talks over the years about how we use open source in the real world in a large company whose role in life is not selling software. Companies that just use this stuff to build their own information technology infrastructure and run their business. And the reason I was so enthusiastic to do that, and the reason that I've labeled myself for want of a better term for now, is I haven't earned a single penny consulting since I quit. I can't call myself a consultant with any honesty. And open source advocate sounds kind of a nothing, so I invented that label. And the reason I've become an open source advocate is because the media and the public discourse on this topic about what the enterprise wants, what CIOs and CTOs and other impressive three-letter acronyms and people with seven-figure salaries want, is completely different from what those of us in the information technology trenches, if you will, people doing the real world, building real systems want. And it's not always necessarily the same. You're getting a completely different story from the commercial software vendors about what is in an enterprise from what's really being used in the real world. And especially as open source, in Linux in particular, began to scare some of the larger vendors, the flood just simply cranked up. Now, I'm not going to talk about Skull at all today. I think we've probably already heard enough bullshit about that whole role. But that's just an example of how the flood machine from proprietary software vendors has really been cranked up in the last few years to spread a lot of nonsense about open source. And there's a real shortage of people who use it in these large companies who could actually get out here and talk. I couldn't give this talk last year, precisely because of the Skull talk. And that's one of the reasons I left where I work. I don't work at Morgan Stanley anymore because I could not go and do interesting things like this to stand up and spread what I think is the truth to counter some of the bullshit that's out there from these large companies. The last conference I was at was the Open Source Business Conference back in April. The introductory bullshit will stop from the notch. You're going to talk in a moment. You'll see some slides here. That was a very, very interesting experience because you had this gathering of about 700 people there to talk about how open source is used from a business perspective, from the top down of the corporate hierarchy. Sitting there with 700 people, Jonathan Schwartz, this keynote, stands up and says, "So how many of you are CIOs, CTOs, where hands go up all over the room? How many of you write software for a living?" And I'm one of 10 guys who raised his hand in the entire room. Boy, did I feel out of place there. I was the only one with visible tattoos anyway, who wouldn't admit it. But the interesting thing about this conference was that the thread was all these venture capitalists and people working for a lot of small startups, and in some cases even very large companies like my own, and so the competitors we had. Fidelity had 5 people there at this conference, so they were really excited about the whole topic. Focusing on how, and trying to explain to people how open source was fundamental to building these business models that very successful companies are now running off of. And more importantly, how the open source model was a positive thing for these money-hungry capitalists. I don't know how to find a better way to put it. And that was really, I'm also going to the Open Source Business Review to talk about this same thing. And these conferences are new, and they're exciting to me because up until now, all the geek conferences like OSCon, Lisa, Usenix, all these conferences were a gathering of people like us who do this in the real world and build real technology. But for the large part, the people from the business world to some degree ignore us. Now you have this new upswing of these conferences. Open Source Business Conference is the second year running now. It's been very, very successful, really grown by leaps and bounds. The Open Source Business Review is being run parallel to the OSCON in Portland this summer in August. And it's attracting the attention of the venture capitalists, of people from very, very large companies who are now looking seriously at the successes of places like Morgan Stanley who have built infrastructures in open source. Success at places like Fidelity, where they also have some very interesting technology infrastructure, and a lot of other companies where it's just simply become a well-known fact that without open source, they could not have built the businesses they have. So this talk is really one, I'm being lazy, I'm just regurgitating something I did 2 years ago like anybody else. I figure if Jeffrey Moore can get up there and note this model he's had to a book you wrote 15 years ago and still give talks, I can redo this one at least once 2 years later. I don't think that's unfair. You all have my unexciting homepage and my email address, so let's get going here. My background is not terribly interesting. I'm a scientist by training, but an engineer by experience. My interest has been in building real-world systems, solving real problems in the real world. Not in writing some software that I can sell to put millions of dollars in my pocket. I'm not here to sell you anything. I'm here to tell you a story of how I've seen open source software used and how its role has evolved with the title in the enterprise. And I mean that in a generic sense. My experience has been in basically only two companies. I've had two jobs, and I really hope by the end of the year, so this is my mortgage company, that I get a third one. With a Japanese company where I became a systems administrator and built a lot of their technology infrastructure. Then for 13 years or almost, then Morgan Stanley doing a lot of things. And in both cases, open source was really key to what we did. Very briefly, when we talk about the enterprise, what are we talking about? I'm not talking about, you know, the technology they built to run, say, just this store. Or I'm talking about the technology they built to run, say, the network of this store and every single Apple store that they have across the country. Diversity is, to me, what really defines the complexity of the enterprise. It's not just a single dimension of scale. It's not how many machines you have or how many users log into your system. It's a little more complicated than that. Now, in the Morgan Stanley case, I can talk about them now because I don't work anymore. Gotta do that, just once. You're not the guys I'm gonna rub that into, unfortunately. None of them are here. The businesses that we were in at Morgan Stanley were really, really broad and diverse. We were in virtually every subset of the financial industry that you can think of. Mergers and acquisitions. We have an entire equities division, fixed income division, you name it. I consider to list all these different divisions that do very, very different things. And all of that, each of those businesses have their own set of distinct problems that have to be solved. They all have different technology requirements. Some of these business units care an awful lot about uptime. Some of them are willing to be cheap and don't. The regulatory requirements vary wildly from business to business. And some of these, you also have different budgetary constraints. You have business units willing to spend a lot of money, and some of them pretty cheap. Actually, pretty high, I'd say they're all cheap, right? Okay, so now I guess everyone's constrained. The other thing that made our environment diverse there was that we were spread around the world. It was six continents, I'm not going to make the Antarctica joke, but it's getting old. Well over 52. These numbers are 2 years old. I'm not going to update that. We're probably in far more cities than that now. But the key there was that not only are we spread around the world, but these sites vary wildly in size. You have sites that, like in New York City, there are thousands of machines down to some of the little small branch offices where it can be counted in 2 digits. Some sites, when they initially started off, would have maybe 5 or 6 servers and 15 clients. That's it. The challenge there was trying to design a technology infrastructure that would scale up to solve the really big problems, which today are the most interesting ones, in a huge metropolitan network like New York City or London or Tokyo or Hong Kong, the 4 main core sites, but also that scales it down to provide the same services in some way in a cost-effective manner to these small branch offices. Platform diversity, we had everything. I'm not going to go through these. We have a whole bunch of little things that we always think we decommissioned, and 2 years later you find out, no, it's still running, and we hadn't actually got rid of it yet. You always have a lot of different systems that are your primary production systems, but those are the ones you care about most. The little legacy systems are a headache and pain in the ass, but they represent a degree of diversity that you often get surprised that you can't ignore. We have a very diverse development environment, a very diverse group of developers. I don't know what the number is now. How many people have an IT now? 3,000? How many people I'm still doing this 6 months later. You have an IT now. It's like 3,000 people. Over 1,000 developers working on a list of software products that would not loud enough. Okay, that would, it's too long to even attempt the list. The diversity in developers is a real challenge. We have some really, really brilliant, smart people working there. A couple of whom are sitting in the front row. I'm not going to name who. I'll let you guys see that. And from wildly varying backgrounds, and the expertise variance goes to both ends. We have the geniuses and we have the flaming idiots. But the bad part is that a lot of time the people that the hardcore geeks claim are idiots are really just people who are hired for a business reason. We hire somebody because they really understand the business side of the problems they're solving. And they think they can code, but they really can't. Unfortunately, the code that these people write, the software they put together, the things they think are architected, that are Goldberg contraptions, have to be put into production, and you have to live with some of that nonsense. And your boundary condition is not imposing these ridiculous constraints of perfect software development, which you've tried and failed to do over the years. The constraint is that if someone can show that it works and makes them money, you're going to wind up running in production. And that results in a very, very diverse range of quality of software. Linguistic diversity comes along with being geographic. I don't think that's terribly interesting anymore. Programming language diversity. Here's another one that makes the enterprise complex. We write in almost everything. I mean, even Smalltalk is one of those languages we thought we decommissioned. 5 years later, we found out it was still running. so many things come back to haunt you. And some of these ones on this minor list are on the way out, some on the way in. You can probably guess which. It surprises people to see us with a C down there, since like 90% of the open source that's out there up until a few years ago, you could argue if it was compiled, it was in C, and it probably was true. The focus is typically to do application development in something, a quote-unquote higher-level language. And so for that reason, directly writing stuff in C, unless you're hacking the kernel, which you probably shouldn't do in the first place, is really discouraged. There's very little direct C written at Morton. So before I ramble on this slide, the point of that to make there is that when we talk about an enterprise, trying to understand what works in an enterprise, trying to define what an enterprise is, means trying to understand in what ways the company, the business that you're looking at or analyzing is diverse in all these different dimensions, and then probably in some others that wouldn't matter to Morgan Stanley. Geographic diversity per se, the Jet Propulsion Labs, is an even bigger problem than we have at Morgan Stanley. We at least can stay with on this planet. JPL gave a really interesting talk at one of the DC conferences a few years ago, describing their attempt to have a DCE cell that actually spanned a bunch of the satellites and probes that were all over the solar system. And you thought latencies between cities was bad. Breaks a lot of fundamental assumptions about the software. You thought you were at least operating within the same planet. No, they're going to take it out to other parts of the solar system, and as you might expect, the probe stops working in really strange, unpredictable ways. So I have this firm belief that if you're going to give a talk that includes managers at all, you got to come up with some like alliterative set of bullet points that will catch their attention so that they walk away and remember something from your talk. And this is a slide with a subtle subliminal message to impress the managers. I just wanted to point that to you. So I didn't think they wanted to hear it. Normally I don't say that, or it wasn't work. But here I figured I could let this figure out. I came up with this to try to describe what it is that we do as systems integrators when you're trying to design this enterprise, to manage an enterprise. I don't mean this in the hijacked term of enterprise management, like modeling software and alerts, that type of whole category of software. I'm talking about the job of building and architecting and maintaining your own IT infrastructure. The three C's are configuration management, change control, and capacity planning. These are three things I spent almost all my time on. Integrating a piece of software is all about figuring out how to manage that configuration, how to customize it for your environment. Change control is a completely different problem. Change control is, this is the upgrade problem, as well as the decommissioning problem. How do I get new versions of software out there in an incredibly diverse environment where new versions of software is a list thousands and thousands of pages long? How do I upgrade these things and decommission the old versions in the same fashion? How do I get an emergency patch rolled out without toppling the entire planet, which I've personally done before? And the last C, the capacity planning one, this is the one where you're most reactive. In the best case, we've always been proactive in the first two, aggressively managing our configurations. We had a very good change control methodology and some pretty good software for doing that. But capacity planning is the one where I think everyone to a certain degree fails, because you can do it in two ways, proactive and reactive. The proactive is the stuff you see coming. You predict a major market event, there'll be billions of trades that day, prepare for all hell to break loose and plan accordingly. And then there's the reactive stuff, which is there was a billion trades today and the system didn't handle it? Oh shit, what do we do? And you have to deal with both problems. And if you don't have a good system for doing change control, you are not going to be able to react to the problems you face in trying to do capacity planning. Enterprises are like fingerprints. I like this quote. Maybe someone will attribute this to my name and then I could die and put my name in a poker book somewhere to say I was famous. I really do believe they're like fingerprints because no two are the same. Get any two people who've worked for years building somebody's infrastructure together, and they can talk just as long about what they have in common and just as long about what they don't. We do things very differently in some respects than some of the other people on Wall Street. In particular, we're trying to differentiate ourselves by doing things better in some ways than they are. And in that way, they're intentionally distinct. Even if I take the best guy from my team that knows everything I did over the last 2 years, put us in two different new companies that have the same business, and I guarantee you over a couple of years what we do will look very, very different. Because the whole point of building an enterprise technology infrastructure is to craft it. It's an art. You have to figure out how to mold all these different products you have, glue them all together to solve your business's problems. You will share some problems with other people in your business sector, but there will always be things unique to you. If not, why are you still in business? If you're doing things the same as everyone else, then you're just a commodity business and you're pretty much soon going to be margined away. You've got to do something unique. And for that reason, really, I do believe this is true. They really aren't the same. And this is the reason you can't go buy, Enterprise version 102 in a box, like they have all that stuff on the wall over there. It doesn't work like that. So So infrastructure software, this is the area I've worked in, and this is really what I want to talk about, how open source is used. Now, you can try to build an infrastructure for free. In the real world, you're going to wind up buying some proprietary software, whether you like it or not. In a business of almost any size, it really is a hybrid. The key is to understand that all the stuff you buy, all the stuff that you download off the net, or get from any source, these are building blocks. They're like the raw material. The best analogy I've heard for the art of building information technology infrastructure is really the construction industry, except that we're a few hundred years behind them in terms of maturity. You're buying building blocks and raw materials, and maybe some tools, but you're not buying the infrastructure. That's what you build. What you build with them is the infrastructure you have. I guarantee you, you cannot build a large infrastructure without writing some kind of code. It just cannot be done. There will be some degree of development done to put all this stuff together. So it's really not a question of if, it's a question of how much. And really, the more diverse your environment is, the more you're going to be building, because the more diverse your environment is, the less likely it is that those off-the-shelf solutions and canned products are going to scale the way you need them to. That's what we spent, and these poor guys are still suffering, spending most of their time doing, is figuring out how to take these products that were never intended to be run at the scale we want to run them at, and to stretch them a lot farther than the vendor wanted. Now, some of you, what we do is like, you know, buying a Volkswagen Beetle and trying to drive it into Le Mans. This is, unless you really spend an awful lot of money sipping it up, this is probably not going to work. Yet we still go back to vendors and complain that we finished last, even though it wasn't the car I was intended for. But hey, when you pay millions of dollars for software, you feel that, and this isn't true, of course, but if you do so much, you have a right to abuse the vendor when they get cocky about their code being as great as it claims is. So where does open source software fit in enterprise? This is the question that I think a lot of the people are debating now. Now that there's, today, there's really no question that open source-based technologies, Linux, Apache, the entire LAMP stack, and I could go on and on and on about 50 some of the big products, like BSD, I guess I better mention that, that might be politically smart, wouldn't it? I'm a Mac user, I don't do OS anymore, they're boring to me. I did that for years, I lived in that hell, I'm to a higher place now, I think. I lost my train of thought. So the debate isn't whether it fits anywhere, the question is where. And people are claiming that, well, you can use Linux. Okay, yeah, Linux will be, but you just use it for specialized things like firewalls, and it'll never really scale. You hear all this bullshit over and over again, but the debate isn't a matter of whether or not people are going to buy and use it. The question is trying to argue over where it's really appropriate. And the main argument here there is from the big, large commercial software vendors, who I think a lot of them, like I've even given up on the operating system and said, we'll sell you that junk that fits on top of it, though. They've argued that, they've given up the operating system, but they're still making this argument that open source development methodology will never tackle the really large software products at the top. And I think what we're going to see as I work through this, I think they're all very scared because they see that the pillar is crawling out from under them. So where does this fit in? Okay, now we do the evolving role detail, and I'm going to grossly paraphrase how we used open source at Morgan Stanley and Tom over there. I joined the company in 92, and at the time I was working with people who had been there for 4 or 5 years before, and have since talked to people who were performing, trying to get a picture of where you just came in. In the 80s, enterprise data processing was basically dominated by mainframes. And there will always be parts of our business that are probably dominated by mainframes just because they were at one time, and we can never get off of that thing. Which is not necessarily bad, but that's what we're talking about. Unix was originally used for research and engineering. Okay, people wanted to develop a platform they could do. Remember that you're working with individual IT back in apparently the late 70s, everyone, there were two computers, test and talk. That was it. Two machines. And people had two terminals. The developer had a test terminal and a prod terminal. They're like different colors, so you knew what we were doing on each keyboard. And life was easy and simple, black and white, night and day. It wasn't very complicated. Hope you went back to it. Very, very rigid environment, of course. Very slow development cycle. Controlled by draconian control freaks, which is not necessarily a bad thing either. That's another talk. And Unix originally was sort of a foothold for doing the research and engineering, primarily because it was considered to be a rapid application environment, development environment. The whole systemd culture originally was built on what we didn't have this acronym, but what was basically the open source of the day, where we could get and download for free, that were the tools used to build on top of the OSs we got from the vendors to put together a network. Now, in the early 90s, as we began to get more and more of these engineering workstations and start to build distributed networks, and really leverage them for more and more of the actual data processing and user interfaces for the users. Unix started to get out of the research and development phase and was really used in production. When I joined the firm in 92, we were using Unix and information systems primarily in the fixed income trading area and in the equities trading area to do all this arbitrage stuff I don't understand and have absolutely no interest in, so I can't really talk about it. But that platform was really key to what those two businesses did at the time. We began to use the open source languages, in particular Perl and TippleDK, because it was the only thing to do GUIs in that was really scripted at the time. Actually, the only reason I think Tickle survived was because of TK. TK never just said Tickle would have died the rapid death it should have died, so no offense to Tickle users. And then later, Python or Ruby, I think, they're still never got the foothold that they need to really be used there, but they do have the potential. The problem Python or Ruby have is we did such a damn good job with Perl that they have a really steep cliff to climb before they get the functionality we have with Perl in the scripting language. So it's kind of hard to argue that you want to have to invest all the money and time in supporting all of them when you have one bit. And then that area being the Perl bigot and the guy who built that environment, my opinions are entirely biased. We then start using open source infrastructure software. Now, all the basic things you'd expect. Now, bind and send. I mean, who in the right mind would build a DNS infrastructure not on bind anymore? It's the default no-brainer solution. That's just what you do. But none of this stuff was really noticed, to be honest with you. This was really all under the radar. Under the radar in the sense that when IT management is spending lots of money on software and the whole process for purchasing things, they're not seeing any of these costs, and they're not managing it. It was used by the people building the infrastructure. I like to say it's literally a grassroots sysadmin culture up, not from the management down that brought all this stuff in. That's really the key point here. No one paid any attention until we kind of got to the mid to late 90s when things started to change. Data processing, this is when we saw an explosion in Unix. We went from 1,000 to 10,000 machines over like a 2 or 3 year period. And it's just mushroom since then. I don't know what the total numbers are. But it's huge. We just cannot seem to... We buy machines as fast as we can buy comms rooms to shove them into. The rate at which we acquire technology is frightening. If you're paying for it, wonderful if you're the company selling it to us. You saw the rapid growth of some of these open source alternatives to commercial software. This is when the LAMP stack, if you will, began to raise its head. And it began to threaten some of the commercial vendors. But we did not really until the late 90s start doing anything serious with banks. Or Apache. It was only around 2000 that came. What also changed in the environment was this last little point here. You began to see companies that offered commercial support for this stuff. The argument up to that point, and the reason that we liked staying under the radar, was that the support argument was a hard one to win with corporate management when you couldn't get that 800 number and you couldn't get that comfort factor of a contract signed by lawyers with all the appropriate absurd fees that go with it. This is a security blanket for modern IT managers even to this day. And that's an important thing. Be one throat to choke. Now, I personally think it's all smoke and mirrors and does not buy you any value whatsoever in a real enterprise, but some people want it, and they need a copy to want it too. So what happens, what has changed now in the 21st century? Let me go back to the previous slide. There's an important point to make about what changed in the late 90s. When Perl 5 came out, that was a big inflection point for how open source was viewed and changed. When Perl 5 came out, and we started building really serious apps as CPAN started to grow in 1995 and 1996. What we're standing is having a debate over what the official allowed language should be. Now, what this really was the Kill Smalltalk Committee. And a few of those other languages that they really wanted to get rid of. And so the plan was, okay, well, we'll make it official. We'll leave your ass off the list. Well, Matthew, the first list did not include Perl, and I went ballistic. Some of you six really appreciate. I was really livid. And I went all the way to the top to the top of IT at the time to argue that this was ridiculous. They could not take us off the list. They'd basically be decertifying the bulk of their infrastructure that was running the business that day. And this is when we began to shine the light on. You can't do that. Look at all the stuff we use. Well, guess what? Now it's coming out of the dark. And there was a lot of ugly and livid, the wrong word. Lively debate over whether or not we should be using any of this stuff. The people who were the proprietary software advocates were saying, this is a huge risk. You have to get rid of all this crap. He said, fine, you won't have any Unix infrastructure if you do that. And simply by demonstrating that we were able to build these large complex applications, easily as complex as what the Java people were failing to do with the infrastructure they were claiming really did up work, run. We made a system that was right once, run anywhere. Okay, on all the entire mortgage transition. We did it, it worked, and it was like, still to this day, is, at least for the Perl environment, okay, little tweaks of distributions not being made aside and flaws like that. For the most part, you can do that. You can write code in New York City, and you can run it on basically any machine around the entire planet. It works to the maximum degree possible. That works to a large degree across platforms as well. That would be the intention of the system. It's actually possible to do that. And we demonstrated, okay, we didn't go out and have to argue and, you know, find white papers and an 800 to call to prove that Perl could be used to build mission-critical infrastructure. We did it. So we didn't ask for permission. We simply begged for forgiveness later. And that worked. In fact, I can say I based most of my career on doing things and asking for permission later. When I give the talk to the AFS best practice, I have to spend 5 minutes telling how we built the AFS infrastructure there, which is doing stealing hardware. They would not give us the disk we needed, so we were literally robbing them. If you put a disk in the equipment room and you did not plug it onto a machine, it was gone in 2 days. In fact, we got real desperate. We would go on to boxes and look to see who did they figure this out. So they started plugging them in, but not mounting any partitions or formatting them. So we just wrote some scripts that would find all the disks that were on the machines that had not been used, tag them, mark them, and JROM and I. This is actually JROM did all this. If the charges ever filed, I was just an accomplice. And we'd steal the disks out of your machines. So one guy would be on the console, other guy in the equipment going to the phone. Okay, did you hold it? Great. It's out. Okay, continue. Great. Go. We got a disk. It's up entire infrastructure like that. It was internal thievery, though. That's okay. Right? We're just reallocating firm resources in a more efficient way. That's what we look at. Now, obviously, that doesn't hold well in larger society, but hey, if you get away with an adventure career, more power to you. The point about Perl 5 is really an important one. That was really the point in which open source came out of the shadows, if you will. Okay, and we had to make a stand and say, no, this is a valid development language. Now, it's been an ongoing battle between, of course, the real programmers who do things in C++ and Java, who keep inadvertently leaving Perl off the list by saying not hiring people to take care of it. And you guys know I'm bitter about this, so I won't ramble on. But it's been a fight to keep it there. But the reality is, it is, whether or not management agrees or not, if you simply look at what's running the infrastructure, Perl runs a huge chunk, most, if not all, to a varying degree, of the software that manages the Unix infrastructure itself, and an increasing amount of software that manages the rest of the infrastructure as well, including actual applications that are running the business. Shock of shocks. That just changed everything. Now, what's happened in the industry in the 21st century? Some interesting things have happened. We've seen the emergence of real enterprise open source software applications. This stuff's, I don't give a damn about the CRM industry at all, but I find it fascinating that it's one of those industries that people would have assumed would never draw the interest of the open source development community. Well, maybe it didn't draw the interest of the quote-unquote community, but what it did draw the interest of was a lot of the people working for companies fighting with the CRM problem. And it's sort of a wanted and someone will build it type of problem. Not build it, they will come, but wish it's there. And it appeared like magic out of the open source community. A guy I like an awful lot, Rommel Lefkowitz, gave a talk a couple years ago where called The Missing Open Source Projects. And he was talking about areas where, like, distributed cron, messaging, my arch enemy of my career, IBM MQ Series. The part there. There's nothing competing against that in the open source world. He listed all these areas where it looked like the commercial software vendors owned the market because the open source wasn't responding. And here, a year and a half later, there is a valid living and breathing community with an open source product that solves every single thing he listed. And I think that's simply because this development paradigm works and it's optimized for the people that use the software. Okay, the people that actually need it and the people that want it, not the people who are trying to sell it to you. Mark Andreessen, I wish I had that list. Mark Andreessen gave this really good list of 12 reasons why open source was going to succeed and simply couldn't fail. I wish I had the list with me. But it amounts to think basically to the fact that open source is going to enable software companies to be successful, an entire new business model. It's going to enable the end users of software to implement technology that solves their business problems and focus their funds on solving business problems, not paying what amounts to the ransom that you have to pay to keep on using the same crap over and over year after year. It's just simply working. Now, one of the other big changes is you have companies that are doing OSF testing and certification. This is different than support. You can go buy support. For example, we got support for, excuse me. We bought support for Apache from Covalent at one point, but then we had a nightmare integrating it. Because they compile it and compile Mob Pro one way, and well, all of our Pro modules are compiled with a slightly different option, and guess what? It corn ups when you try to mix the two. Integration challenge. That's what we do. in Unix's engineering group. We're not systems administrators, and we're not developers. We're something in between. You're a systems integrator. Your job is to build, write the code you write, and the glue that puts all this stuff together. What SpikeSource and Source Labs are both doing, though, is trying to give you an integrated tested stack, you know, a fixed slice of version numbers. If you look at if you look at what's in a Linux distribution, okay, you know, people are naive. They get the, you know, Linux Fedora X.Y CD and go, oh, it's a new version. Well, it's actually about 20,000 new or plus new versions. I don't know how many different packages of distinct software make up a single Linux distribution, all of which are moving targets whose version is changing. And somebody had to deal with the headache of saying, okay, stop each of those here and test that combination. And that's what you're buying, you think, when you get, you know, this happy CD from Red Hat or from Debian or through one of these distribution vendors. These companies are doing that now for the LAMP stack as a whole. They're trying to give people the unify, you know, the whole Linux, Apache, MySQL, and then pick your extension of PHP, Perl, or Python, and all this other open source stuff. You want to glue onto that to make to build something that's going to run your enterprise. The biggest problem you're going to have, you can get all the components for free, but you're going to spend weeks, if not months, if not years, fighting with integration issues. And these companies are now tackling a problem space that I think will make open source even more competitive. Now, if you're like a Morgan Stanley, you can hire thousands of people, you can get smart, brilliant guys like these guys and me, who can do that integration stuff, who are very good at it, then you don't necessarily need this. But if you're a smaller company that cannot afford to make that investment, then this suddenly makes the whole LAMP stack far more appealing as an application development platform, because you can get something which is unit tested, and we're talking about a much, not just the stuff that's on the typical Linux distribution team, but a far broader range of software that gives a lot more functionality. And if you look at both these companies' websites, they're already up and running. They're also doing this as a service. And they offer their testing resources to the open source developers for each of these products that they're unit testing, so that they have a resource for doing more regression tests. And working with the community, they're not just a proprietary company doing the testing and making you pay for their results. They're also involving the community and providing resources for the open source development community, a wide range of them, to actually be involved in doing this testing as well. And it's a really, I think they have a very positive business model, and I think what they're doing is really going to revolution. It's going to open up a whole new market for open source in sort of the medium to small range businesses, because there has always been this critical mass you have to have if you want to do this stuff. You've got to require the minimum skill set you have to actually be able to, you know, configure and integrate all these components and do something useful with it. It's not just download, you know, configure, make install, hey, it's done. It's a lot more difficult than that. And if you can't afford to have that critical mass, you need to be able to offload that testing integration services onto somebody else. Up till now, you could do it piecemeal on a consulting basis. These two companies are going to take it to a new level and do it for the stack as a whole. I think this is going to make the LAMP stack far more legitimate. Jonathan Schwartz really pissed me off in his keynote, because he said there are only two stacks in the world that matter, and he's talking about the application development space. And he put up there .NET and J2EE. And I'm in the front going, shut up. He didn't talk about LAMP at all. And in his opinion, it was non-player. And I don't think anyone else was stupid enough at that conference in particular, this is the Open Source Business Conference, to talk about those stacks and not give LAMP its legitimate say. I really want to see Jonathan Schwartz make him look like an idiot when the LAMP stack winds up putting the Java stuff out of business. I know, I can fantasize, but I can dream. It's not going to happen. All of these stacks are going to survive because legacy software never gets deinstalled. So once it's out there running somebody's production, believe me, it's around forever. But I do think that the key here will be that LAMP is going to be a lot more marketable. And that is going to change a lot of things over the next couple of years in the whole world. I do believe the proprietary world is getting scared. They're getting scared to death because a lot of these companies see that their business models are not sustainable over time. Microsoft is not doomed. They're way too smart for that. But I do think they know that their Windows and, you know, Office ransoms that they have on the rest of the planet are going to dry up and vanish at some point. I do believe that there's no reason for people in third world countries in particular to invest an awful lot of money in proprietary software that just pumps all those resources out of their economy and into somebody else's. And these countries know that, and that's why a lot of them are fighting to make open source a requirement. Now, I'm not going to go into all the bullet points there. There are places we're winning, there's places where we're losing. I think over time, open source is going to win at the end of the day, because it just simply is free and cheap, and you can't stop it. Other reason is because the world has changed to one where this is a whole much more inclusive process. Anybody who has access to the internet can participate. Go on to SourceForge. Find a product that's a problem that's interesting to you and a software being written to solve it. Join the party. Anyone can do this. And there is no, the barrier to entry here is very, very low. I know the net does not reach around the entire planet, but it reaches an awful lot of people. And that resource alone enables them to participate in a development culture that's inclusive instead of exclusive. And I think that's other reasons for succeeding. Okay, so I wasn't talking about Skull, but there's one thing, a couple things to say about that. Skull's not the only one doing this, of course. I think the degree to which a proprietary vendor is scared about their business model is reflected in their anti-open source attitude. The smart companies like IBM have figured out where the losing battles were, and I think it's kind of, well, they haven't given up on it, actually, even a lot of us wish they would. But they certainly embrace Linux and the concept of open source pretty well. This is for a company that is definitely conservative with a capital C. So in that sense, that's encouraging to me. A few of these companies are realizing that they need to learn to live with and adopt to, or not adopt, strong word, they need to learn to, I guess, coexist with open source world and not make it an ongoing battle. And it's in our interest to do so.
What do you think the difference, like, if people remember the early 90s, mid-90s, it was like heterogeneity in your office is the norm, you know?
Still is. Nothing's changed, man. Okay.
Even in a small, you can have 60 users in an office, you can have every possible OS running in a way that is not true today. How about that?
Well, yeah, there was more diversity in the early 90s. There were a lot more Unix workstation vendors. The fun job I had in Matsusa was trying to make, for every Unix English language release of an operating system, the Japanese had their own Japanese language release of it, and they weren't the same. They're very different. So I had a number of platforms times two problems to worry about. And that was fun when in the beginning it was fun. Now I know where the pain in the ass is. There was a lot more diversity then, and I think there's a little bit less now in terms of platforms. I'm not so sure that's a bad thing. I mean, you basically, I'm not saying I list of all, but...
That's really my question. What do you think the difference is between the heterogeneity of today versus, say, that?
The death of all the competing PC vendors. And, I mean, we basically dried out to, the Windows and the Mac, and that's it. And not discounting the growing Linux community. We're talking about the proprietary, desktop operating system. There's not a whole lot out there that really has enough of market share to get really excited about. Certainly at the enterprise level. Yeah, that's BOS. It looks like those little tiny guys, but really it's Windows and Mac for all intents and purposes in the corporate world. And on the Unix side, you have the death of all the competing Unix vendors. So, and that's a good thing. You can have too much competition and too much diversity there, and I think it is healthy for the companies that, well, in the perfect world, you'd like the ones that were bad companies, the bad technologies die off and disappear, and the ones with the good technology to survive. And unfortunately, in many cases, the exact opposite has happened. But the world isn't fair. If you haven't figured it out by now, you're really in trouble. I don't know that it's going to reduce an awful lot more than it already has. I think there's still a few Unix vendors that eventually will probably just give up and jump on the Linux bandwagon. I mean, almost all of them have at least one foot in those waters because they know that if they don't learn to swim over there, they're not going to have a Unix offering someday. So there may be a little bit less diversity like that. But I think it's pretty much consolidated on Unix, Windows, Mac, and then the mainframe platforms in the corporate world. But it seems a lot. Yeah. Open Solaris is interesting to me, but I think Sun's a little late. The only Open Solaris is going to succeed and be useful to us on the Intel platform is if they could do something like what Red Hat did, which is go out there and get all these other third-party vendors on board. In coming up with, because the nightmare that we dealt with in trying to get Linux in the Morgan Stanley a few years ago was the fact that we couldn't get driver manufacturer X to give us this kernel, the same kernel version as driver manufacturer B. So you line up all the third party options, they say, well, I work with this version, that version, and there's no working subset for all of them. They managed to bring some sanity to that space, and that's a business issue. That was Red Hat partnering with Veritas and all these EMC and all these other companies in the hardware space to do that. If Sun can do the same thing, and they have a lot of those relationships, then and provide an offering which get support from the third party vendors, they succeed. Without them, I think it's academic and it's not interesting.
Maybe for later, but have you seen anybody in the completely open source space do pull up really good driver integration across the board, like in ways that they?
Well, that's not really my. I don't really know that area so much. Wait, say it one more time so I can say it one more
time. Directly in open source, we've actually solved a lot of the driver issues
Anyone in the open source world who has solved the vendor issues in the same way? Well, I'm not a super big fan of Red Hat anymore. I think they turned into their son, to be honest with you. But that's exactly what Red Hat did, and I think was successful in that. So they have the whole enterprise Linux. That's why, when we were debating which unit Linux to do in the beginning, it came down to not choosing the one we thought was technically the best. I think the consensus at the time is probably leaning towards Debian as a more, then anyway, as probably the best, technically best distribution. And then we had Fanatics. This is like Emacs versus VI wars, okay? The camp who believed which Linux distro was the best one was a ridiculous form. And in the end, we didn't choose the technically best one. We chose the one that had the best set of business relationships that we needed to get for the big picture. I think Red Hat did it. That was the real reason that Red Hat has been real successful. If other companies don't do the same, they're going to find it difficult to even run very big enterprises, which is a double-edged sword. Now, one of the things I decided by working 13 years at Morgan Stanley is the bigger you get, the less fun it is. It was a lot more fun 10 years ago when we were starting off and we were stealing disks and comm rooms and robbing the backup guy's spare spark tens. I mean, those were the good old days. We were the cowboys. That was fun. And it just increasingly got less fun as things got bigger. If you really get excited about going to sell software to these guys, be ready for a rough ride. If you charge me $10 million for software, I'm going to squeeze $10 million of support out of your people and then some. I'm going to get my money's worth, because that's the way we are. It's kind of a sick, twisted place. I'm glad I'm not there anymore. I don't want you guys to feel bad or anything. I'm sure you're still enjoying your jobs. People talk about, Red Hat is there for the best Linux to go and the most successful. No, Red Hat is focused on the enterprise market. Okay, the other Linux distributions are probably quite rightly ignoring the large sector and going after small and medium-sized businesses, educational market, or just individual private users, and they will be very successful. There is enough diversity in the marketplace for all these different business models to succeed. But in the enterprise context, though, to be successful there, the key would be to take the same approach that Red Hat did. And go out and make all those business partnerships, and that requires a pretty big, a pretty good group of people and a pretty big business structure to be able to go off and do that. That's not a trivial thing to do. Okay, a couple more slides, and then we can just keep. Then I'll answer even more questions for a little more. I believe that it's inevitable that the presence of most enterprises is going to grow and expand. It will spread globally aggressively. And I think it's going to continue to prove to have a very, very low total cost of ownership. And it's not possible to build enterprise entirely out of open source yet, but I do think eventually it will be. I think that's maybe 5 to 10 years away. But if you look at what happened in the CRM space, where there was no CRM software whatsoever, and Sugar CRM pops up, and now there's like 10 companies supporting and selling distributions and offering services in that whole market, and all of them growing and doing very well, I think that the same model is going to be applied as you keep moving up the so-called application stack into larger and larger business applications. There will be more and more open source infrastructure. And so if you sell infrastructure software, then the lower in the stack you are, the higher risk you are. Okay? If you're selling infrastructure software, eventually you're doomed. The lower in the infrastructure, the more it makes sense to use open source. The higher you get, the more specialized you get. It starts to make sense to buy proprietary applications. If there's enough of a community of people out there that you can build a set of relationships to actually create a developing community, an open source community, to spawn the software you need, proprietary software might make sense. But I do think that the open source model is just simply proving to be the most secure, the best software, and because it's inclusive and not exclusive, for those key reasons, I think it's going to succeed. Oh, I had it. I forgot. I put it in here. My brain is fried. We'll put it out. Beaver is 10 reasons why opportunity to grow. I'm not going to read these through. You can look these up in a Google search, and I'm pretty sure when you double quote there, you do that. But I think these were, I don't want to steal his fire. I do think these are really valid when he said them 2 years ago or so, and they're still valid today. And they're worth thinking about. I don't think that open source can possibly fail unless we allow governments around the world to simply legislate it away, and I don't think that's going to happen. It will succeed. Why does it fit in? Actually, I'm gonna breeze through these. I do this every time I give a talk. I get rambling and then I start talking about the slides that are 3 or 4 ahead. And how much time have I got before? Okay, I know I'll get the queuing eventually. I see people twitching. I think it's categorically easier to integrate in a complex, diverse enterprise. The biggest headache we always have is the little things that the vendors fix for you that they don't care about changing. Hard-coded path names, fixed user IDs, fixed numerical user IDs sometimes. And they don't give you the option to change it. And to the vendor, this is the least interesting thing in the for the vendor to change, but to the software integrator, it's the most important thing for you to figure out how to work around to get the stuff working in your environment. With open source software, if I'm building it from source code, then I have control over those things. If I don't have control over it, I can patch the code so that I have control over that and make it configurable. I can now use more than one version of the software if I can control that. And the key here is that I can do those little tweaks. I have that option. And I don't have that option with commercial software. I have to go and sometimes pay the vendor outrageous sums of money to get a path name to be configurable. Second reason it's easier to customize than yes. This is pretty should be obvious. It's necessary when you're building a large, diverse enterprise to customize a lot of the software. And I'm not just talking about different configure options you can pilot. I'm talking about sometimes we have to go in and add functionality to make it work in our environment. You have that ability. When you don't have that ability with proprietary software, you have to go back and get consulting specials from vendors. Vendors will charge you 6 and 7 figure sums to do some of those mundane, boring things in their code. That was the old days. It's gotten a little more reasonable. With open source, I can either do it in-house, I can hire a consultant to do it, or if I'm really nice, I can just I can just simply dangle an interesting idea in front of the open source development community, and presto, I get the patch I want. That's worked me countless times, just by trying to be nice. I tried hard. I did. And the last reason is it really does have a competitive TCO. Now, I think TCO arguments are almost always funded by the people that want to see the result come out a certain way, and I don't trust any of them. They're all white papers. It's a highly nonlinear, complex environment. You can get any result you want by paying attention to whatever subset of data fits your model. I think they're all bullshit. Yeah, that's what I think of white papers. In reality, open source has simply proved in the real working environment, experimentally, empirically, determined results, not calculated through some arbitrary mathematical model or white paper, to have a low TCO. License costs are very low. Now, I put that in, you say, but they're free. No. Let's face it. The Red Hat subscription fees are just licenses under a different name. Okay? If you go and look at what it costs to buy, like, Windows XP licenses for Enterprise, and they don't know what Red Hat charges for, these subscriptions for all the updates to Red Hat Enterprise, gee, they're kind of in the same ballpark. So, I'm going to call a license. I mean, they've reworded it really nicely, so you're not paying software license fees. You're paying support subscriptions, or whatever they call them. At the end of the day, yes, they're license fees. Generally, much far lower. Support costs vary, but they're usually far, far cheaper than proprietary code. And again, all because you have a lot of options. I think one of the most important reasons is that I have the upgrade schedules in my control. I determine when I decommission a piece of open source code. Okay, the vendor cannot simply say, well, on this date, I'm sorry, can't use it anymore. Call us and we'll laugh at you. We still use code like that. We don't have any choice. But that's what happens to you. When a vendor can't just arbitrarily tell you to upgrade something, and you can't just turn around in 6 months and get it done, that's not a trivial problem, especially for a lot of mission-critical infrastructure software. At least with the open source code, I can control that. That's a huge win. I simply believe, and I will simply assert based on my experience, it continues to be stable, scalable, and secure as a proprietary options, more often than not, better to far better. Canonically observed result. What about support? Okay, support to me is these three things. This is the painful part of the job. 24/7 support for problem resolution. When it breaks, get it fixed. Please make it work again. Bug fixes. Please make it not break again. And enhancements. Make it better. How does open source measure up? Well, two case studies really quick. Perl and OpenAFS have been raving successes at Morgan Stanley. Well, in the AFS case, you could argue raving failure, but that depends on who likes or not. It is considered, except for a few people there whose names can't be mentioned in public, to be a first-class development language, right up there with C++ and Java. We have a broad set of our own internal APIs that have been ported to work with Perl. So for an awful lot of the core infrastructure for which you can write applications in C++ and Java, we have the APIs available to actually develop things in Perl. It's used for very major systems application development, systems management infrastructure and major application development, and we're supported by an in-house community. We don't have commercial support. Is that still true? We had it for a little while, but we couldn't buy it because we weren't using it. And this is the case where the open source, I think this is one of the most interesting points about Perl, the open source support model was what we used internally. With myself, Hildo, a whole bunch of other people that just were on this mailing list that would answer questions. As nicely as we could sometimes. Actually, that list served one very important purpose. It protected you and the outside world from our morons. Hopefully we would get to them before they would post it on, you know, complaining Perl or idiots or whatever, and embarrass us publicly. That's a really good functional internal mailing list, you know. You don't want some of these morons letting people know how stupid. We've had you know, mission critical code with passwords that are posted to public mailing lists by some people who obviously don't want to report there. But the internet, that model has been successful for supporting this in one of the world's largest firms. And I think that says an awful lot for how easy it is, has proven to be to support Perl, and how stable and scalable the language has been. Anybody here know anything about AFS? Oh, poor fools. This most of the pain in my career was caused by this product for a couple years, so I have scar tissue to prove it. This is the primary distributed file system for application deployment. You want to put code in production, it goes to AFS. Now, this is some code that had interesting history because it was originally proprietary. But it was open sourced by IBM when they gave up on this market back in 2000. We were very, very afraid in 1999 when we knew that they were going to end of life the product, but we didn't know they were going to open source it. And so basically they were telling us that rug you're standing on, it's going to get yanked. You will have no support whatsoever for the most critical part of your distributed systems infrastructure. Now, what happened was, as soon as they open sourced it, we created the OpenAFS community, and all these latent patches and interesting development teams that have been doing things with AFS and all the various universities around just sort of sprung back up again, and the community came together really quickly in a couple years, and the rate of innovation has really just increased exponentially since it became open source. The code has been freed, if you will, from IBM. Now, actually, what we really wish IBM would do, now we want them to stop supporting it so everyone will come over to the open source part and leave the old proprietary code behind. That's a bigger problem. But this is an example of a very specialized market where it was not viable for a commercial product, core infrastructure, okay. The margins in the file system market were just shrinking, and IBM was not making any money off this product, so they did their business, they got out of the market. To their credit, they could have just said, you're doomed, and let the product die, let the entire community die, but they chose not to. They gave the code away. I think that was very surprising that they would do that. And they're not the only company that's since been. They're one of the only ones to do so. This is supported commercially by a contract through a company that is supporting an open source technology, a company called Synonome, which does a very good job of this. In fact, some of the smartest people in the AFS development community work for that company. And that's a great example of that market that exists in the open source, in the industry for support and services of open source products. You know, Synonome does not own any of the intellectual property for this code they support. The only thing that they have to sell us are their skills in fixing problems for us, you know, enhancing the code, in things that are much more tangibly of value to us than just paying for the right to have the code in my system. And I think that model, I believe they're being successful at it, I think that model is working for them and working for a lot of other companies, and is a good one. So the conclusions are, every large enterprise has open source, whether they know it or not. If you have Unix, you have Unix systems, ergo you have open source. You just don't may not know it yet. The ones that do know it also acknowledge that it is growing. And it's inevitable. More and more core infrastructure is going to be dominated by open source, and if you use any of that technology, you're going to be using open source. I believe it's going to succeed, and more of these commercial products are starting to fail. As the margins start to shrink on, you know, the boring things that become more and more commoditized, the commercial companies will get out of those markets, and open source will just take over naturally. It will just, like water, fill in to fill up the gas. I think it will remain competitive and surpass proprietary market software. Actually, I wish I'd change this to most markets, because now I honestly believe it's going to be most markets. That's just an assertion. I think innovation in the open source software community, hands down, will continue to produce high-quality software that is ready for the enterprise. Anyone who claims to you that, well, open source is wonderful code, but it's not ready for the enterprise is full of it. Perhaps Linux needs a little more maturity in the driver space to really be competitive against some of the commercial vendors for some enterprise functionality. I can make a list of cons and things that open source has not solved yet, but I can make a much longer list of pros and a much longer list of real problems that open source does solve where it makes sense to use the open source in the enterprise. So, I rambled it up uncontrollably. I'm at the end, and I'd like to open it for Q&A. Well, I'm going to go back up here first.
Him
to you.
Who goes? It's kind of a funny conundrum.
They're becoming big like Sun. It's a scale problem. It's just, I think Red Hat's, okay, he's saying it's kind of a conundrum that, you know, Red Hat's a successful open source company, they're becoming like Sun. Let me explain what I mean by that and pick on Red Hat specifically. Red Hat has become like Sun because they've got this biggest Sun. In the early days, you wanted to solve a problem, you could get in touch with the people that could really solve your problem. Now they have what every big vendor has. They've got N layers of bullshit bureaucracy. You know, the web system you submit plus two, the level one support you call, who can't spell the product name, who addresses level two, who finds level three, who calls you up and solves the problem a day late, and it's no good anymore. It's the same crap. It's the same thing that happens when support doesn't scale that well. Anytime you have to go to having 800 number staff people that don't really understand the product, you're blind. Okay? What we always had to do to get good support for these big products was bypass all that crap. I was ready to throttle some people at IBM over MQ because literally you call the MQ line. Here's how it works. You call the 800 number, you get through to someone who's got some big complex, it must be a mainframe app, that's only I guess, thing that where you go through all these pod codes to get to your product segment, and then you get to your product name, and when she's finally got to that screen, she tells you, okay, we'll have someone call you back. That whole thing takes like 10 minutes. Okay, meanwhile, hell's freezing, you know, markets are failing, traders are winging phones across the floor. Things are going really crazy, okay? You have to understand that, if you work for Boeing and a server crashes, bummer, dude, it's out of smoke. No problem, right? If you work for a bank and your server crashes and you can't get up the options prices, you begin harming people, okay? That's the culture. And that's what an outage means to us. It's not just that things must always be working. They must be working well and efficiently and fast. The options trade, I spent 2 weeks doing floor support in equities, about which there are great stories you've all heard, and I won't tell again, probably because it'll embarrass people hearing me joke. If you get a chance to step onto a Wall Street trading floor for just 5 minutes, just do it, stand there and watch. But you have to do it when things are trading, preferably right after a market opened or just before it closes when the chaos is peaking. And it's a sight to be seen. I mean, these are educated, you know, many Ivy League educated people yelling and screaming like my little 12-year-old son does in a movie game. It's just insane. But the demand being placed on the technology infrastructure is extreme. So a support model where it takes me 30 minutes to get in a reasonably intelligent human being to call me back to just drive the next web interface to the next support system where it starts really getting my problem isn't going to work for me. So we inevitably have to go to negotiate contracts where we get the right to bypass that bullshit. Okay, when my business is at risk and I'm looking at losing billions of dollars for real, or ultimately not making or not losing, depending on how the case may be right now. I once made this morning asked a comment to a guy who said, he said, I'm losing millions. I said, how do you know you're not avoiding losing millions? And he almost
farted. No, I think there's some way of a bad example on me, because in some way Sun is beating Red Hat on the way down.
Well,
I think maybe a more useful example, a firm can be big and actually provide, whatever your feelings are about Cisco, the way that Marco cites it, the way they do support is actually remarkable.
Well, okay, Cisco is a different example. That's a good point.
The router, they go, how do I turn it on?
And that's why Cisco's been successful, because they made it their top-down corporate policy that you would be paid based on the satisfaction of customers more than any other parameter. You may write the most bitching call, but if you told your customer to go fuck off, sorry, Apple, then guess what? You're not getting paid into the air because you were a jerk. They can't fire me. Go ahead. That looks so nice. I can say anything I want, and I can't get fired. Because I'm unemployed. I have business cards. Okay. In a sense, Sun is being on the way down. But that's the risk that any of these companies run when they try to scale up support. As soon as you're using a call center in India or Panama or wherever it is you're doomed, it doesn't scale. Yeah, okay, you have a question.
It might sound like a strange question. I've always kind of wondered why there's very, very few PC like
DSC licensed software, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I think there's the GPL versus BSD license religion war, about which I have personally no interest in, really don't give a damn. I think that's one barrier. The fact that it, you know, thou shalt GPL your code or thou shalt not get its ass in my distribution is one problem. Even with the kernel itself, are you talking about just code from BSD being in Linux? I'm not sure.
That's kind of what I was getting at. Right? I don't see GPL as good in BSD at all. I mean, there's no
GPL doesn't exclude BSD. The people who put a distribution together choose to use software that's only been GPL, and they exclude the BSD license software. That's just the choice of people putting the code together. That's a political issue more than a technical, really. Yeah.
One thing kind of what he said is that any BSD code I can arbitrarily GPL. That's where we're discovering that we start from. And you license a lot of the basis of what you started with. So we had perfect action devices.
Well, yeah, but hold on, you can't. Okay, you're saying that any code that's BSD licensed can be re-GPL? That somehow seems intuitively kind of wrong to me.
I can do whatever the hell I want with it, as long as I say I got it from wherever I got it from. So I can change the license to a less restrictive.
You can include code under the BSD license if properly attributed in code that is itself GPL. That's not the same thing.
No, I can re-GPL the entire project as long as I say where I got it.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't play on TV, and I hope to be asked to play on TV, so I'm really not qualified to comment further on that. Okay. Let me move around. Even this man's been getting his arm sore raising.
Well, I'm shifting that question to something different. You don't end up seeing a lot of BSD and computer financial things. Why should you do in Linux? Is there a reason you can get for that that's interesting?
Is interesting useful?
We're all sitting here.
You see a lot of Linux on Wall Street, you see very little BSD. Why is that? Well,
I mean, is this because a penguin is a lot nicer for the business guy to look at than a little demon?
No, it's not because the penguin is sexier than demon. That's not true. Hands down, I'm convinced that's not it, because neither of them are sexy and they don't give a damn. Most these people don't know what the penguin and the demon are, so that's irrelevant. I think the real reason probably has to do with, well, okay, IBM is a big reason. The reason would be that more companies like Red Hat and IBM popped up to start providing the support, and that hasn't happened in the BSD community. Why has that not happened? I don't know. So the reason behind the reason isn't irrelevant. And I think a lot of that comes back to the relationship that a lot of those existing companies like IBM already have with Wall Street. I could have arbitrarily chosen BSD, I suppose. I don't know what the logic behind one or the other was.
Could it have anything to do with like old 65 versus Berkeley law? Like old school?
Oh, because IBM were old AT&T people versus... Yeah, BSDs have legal issues Linux didn't have. Although people have tried to make as many legal problems for Linux as BSD had. That definitely was a hairpin. That's a good point. I saw an awesome talk that gave the lineage, you know, of all the Unixes over the years, and they talked about all the lawsuits, and recalling that, I think that probably is really the key reason, now that I think about it, would be that there's special legal baggage, and that's been a barrier. And Linux stepped through that window and BSD didn't. Is BSD's doomed? Well, obviously not, or you guys would be sitting here. But I think that's the problem. Steve Jobs had a great quote about when they were giving him a hard time. You know, this reporter, typical journalism doesn't exist in this country anymore, so I don't like to call these reporters, but a guy writing an article for a technical magazine asks him, you know, doesn't it bother you that Apple only has a 5% market share? And he said, BMW has a 5% market share. Next question. And the point here is that we've got this ridiculously absurd focus on being the biggest and number one and the best, or you're a failure. I mean, you know, Cardinals fans should be happy that they made it to the World Series, not be too terribly depressed that the Red Sox humiliated them in four games. Actually, that's not the serious topic to talk about this now. But I'm a Mets fan, and I've been tortured since 2000 by the Yankees fans in Morgan Stanley, and so when the Red Sox won last year, I came into the office for three straight days with nothing but glove. Nothing but glove. And it didn't work. They were all so stoic. Like, what? I couldn't get around none of these guys.
They weren't really Yankees.
No, they weren't. No, they were real Yankees. Okay, anyway, you back the issue. The world is diverse enough and the market big enough for there to be a niche that the BSDs carve out. I mean, FreeBSD releases have been claimed by many to be the most secure OS out there, but it doesn't have all those third-party, you know, doohickeys and widgets and gadgets to pull onto it to make it enterprise-ready. Okay, so it's going to have a hard time in that space. That's irrelevant, though. Okay? The enterprise market is not the only market to go after. And so when people talk in an implicitly negative tone about the companies that are not targeting the biggest and the baddest, I think they're really disrespecting, that's the wrong word, they're misunderstanding the fact that it doesn't matter if you don't place number one. I can go out and found a company working on one of these issues, if I understand it well, and be very, very successful and feed my kids and take them on fun vacations when I feel like it. And that's, why would I not consider that a success? The fact that I'm not targeting, you know, the top is somehow a bad thing. So that's usually the context that that's implied here. It always drives me nuts. I don't think... Well, that's why I talked about in the beginning, spent so much time talking about what I mean by enterprise and what I think we need to think about. It's the top, yeah. We're talking about the large environments. And so when we say enterprise, I think that when the industry says enterprise, that's the market they're talking about, the big companies. Because that's where the big bucks are, but it's also where the big stress is, so watch out.
Just a quick note on the end of that
one. It could be speaking too much for everybody here. There's a ton of financial work in New York, and it's using this stuff. We're trying to take a lot of conversations. I've had some people that are not, how do you fold? How do you be part of this? Because this interesting tech. You know, you don't really want to have these guys as your customers. These are some of the six nicest guys in Morgan Stanley. They don't represent the people you have to deal with to sell software to that company. I think it's not necessarily a market you want to be in unless you're prepared for a lot of stress. There are certainly some high rewards by selling software at that scale, but there's some high risks because I know at one point, the people we bought AFS from, Transart, gave us the stupidest deal in history. Okay, it's like the rush of selling us Alaska. They gave it to us with infinite upgrades, as often as we wanted, you know, on any platform that came out for only $60,000 a year. And they thought that was a good deal. And 3 years into that, at one point I remember they were telling me that we were costing them in support over $1 million a year. And the way I went was, bummer, dude! It sucks for you! You know, the product was just, we built this infrastructure and it just started caving in us on the 96. So I had a close personal relationship with most of the TransArc AFS support staff. And believe it or not, I can actually still call a few of them friends to this day. Although they definitely twitch when they hear my name. And they hear the words Morgan Stanley, they go, yeah, the phone rings, it's Morgan Stanley. It was like, you know, the red phone goes off in the White House. Yeah, I mean, it was... Actually, the guys in the entry support team said they were joking, so they had this little klaxon that would go off, you know, when Morgan Stanley calls. They all knew to leave the room. The last one there was one of the support call. It's a very demanding customer. And in all honesty, unless you are really up for it, be very careful if you are in a business that does not support the financial industry. It could be your best dream, could be your worst nightmare. Because they're very, and we're not, I think we're some of the nicer ones. Nah, that's true. We're all cruel and evil and bottom line oriented. So if you sell me some software for $1 million, be prepared to offer me that much value and support and services. And if you don't, be prepared to take a beating for it. The good thing though is in working with, I think a lot of software products have been made a lot better by tackling that problem. I honestly think that through Red Hat and Morgan Stanley working together to put Linux into that infrastructure, we made Linux overall a lot better. We tackled a lot of problems and encountered a lot of bugs and a lot of issues that people hadn't seen yet. That's called being on the bleeding edge, of course. But the same was true for the AFS product. I mean, the OpenAFS people have said that, you know, a lot of the critical bugs that are fixing release, guess what? They were things that we found and we fixed working in our environment. So it can be good. There are some good things to working at that scale. You will stress your code in ways you haven't stressed it before. Whether or not the code behaves well in those environments or not will determine, I think, how happy you're going to be. But approach that market with caution.
Well, then, finding bugs reporting in Mac, how can you find the enterprise where you're
in Mac? Awesome question. Other than reporting bugs and bitching about it, you're fixing. I'm repeating the question.
Oh, okay.
Stop and listen. Okay. Other than fixing bugs and asking for patches, what are enterprises doing to give back? That's an excellent question. Well, we can brag about I can brag about what they do at Morgan Stanley. We had a policy there of actually, if we wrote some code that we wanted to release, did not give us an advantage in one of our primary businesses. If I didn't like options valuation software or something clever to price a merger acquisition. That kind of stuff they would not release as a rule. But we were allowed to release a lot of the infrastructure code we wrote. So, and there's an entire developed programming language called A+ that was released. It was developed in Morgan Stanley. It's a really sick, twisted APL derivative, which, I mean, he's a character set that is so non-standard that nobody can even look at it. It's just gibberish. I hate it. Thank you. The NQ-Series Perl Suite that I wrote was one of the first packages ever released. That was back in 98. And that was, we had to go, it took me a year to do that, to argue with the lawyers about, you know, why, okay, first they're like, well, why do you want to do this? You know, I'm trying to give them the logic behind it, all my optimistic, you know, reasons behind doing so, which made them go, okay, we're still listening. But at the end of the day, I could simply, by showing, the argument was, look, there's no risk to us in doing so. There's nothing but benefit. Okay, because of the way it's licensed, because I have no obligation to pay any attention whatsoever to anybody who complains about this code, there's really no risk to us. This is quality code that does nothing other than enhance our image in the open source community and get more people from that community to be interested in the things that we do. And I give also arguments, and look, you know, I get, and it was able to show, look, I can get bug fixes for the code. Some people find bugs before I find them, and I get patches back. You can make arguments like that. But at the end of the day, though, because there really wasn't any risk, and there was some benefit, although the tip wasn't really financially tangible, you know, they decided to allow it to go through. And it's, that policy has, I think, been pretty successful. Now, what are other enterprises doing? Well, that really varies. I know that I talked to some people from Fidelity back in April, and they're very, very keen on open source for core infrastructure, and they have given a bunch of code they've written there and things that enhances they've made back to the various open source communities. It really varies from company to company. I think as more IT shops start to appreciate the value of open source from a pure bottom line financial perspective, and they start getting involved in using it, they start to understand, if they're smart, that there is a lot of value in participating in a positive way in the open source community. If you want, you know, bugs posted from your domain name to not be totally ignored, it helps you to become people who are actually participating in a constructive fashion. If your bugs are posted from a domain name that's known to have nothing but bitches and whiners, there will be this implicit, you know, you won't get the same kind of support here for the community. You get to a certain degree, you will get out of it what you put into it, and I think that's obvious to a lot of people. So people are, more and more companies are creating policies about, okay, we write software here, how much time can employees spend on open source projects? These questions are being asked, and people are formulating those policies. I don't know what they are, a lot of the companies. I know it's a moving target for a lot of them, but I do think that the more a company is a user of open source, the more likely they are to actually participate in a positive way. And this varies, of course, across the spectrum. But I think more and more we're seeing more participation, not directly from companies like IBM saying, here's $1 billion, do things with Linux, but in terms of employees at companies who work on, or who use open source, working constructively on those projects. I mean, AFS is an example where most of the people in the commercial world that use it, a lot of the people who work in the commercial use it are some of the biggest contributors to some of the code there, not just people at universities. And that's an example of how people are contributing in a positive way. And it only varies from community to community, but I think the trend is a positive one. No questions. And I can ramble on my own and show us out, so we need it.
It sounds like the biggest issue is creating parts open source and unified. Can you profile
okay, yes, supporting the questions. If I can't repeat the question, I must not understand it. Okay, if I understand this right. So, yeah, support is one of the big issues. And you want me to summarize the last part again?
Profile. The biggest contributor is support.
Typical support issues for open source. Well, most of the issues we have getting support for open source would be, you know, bugs that recur that we can't fix and that the open source community, for example, doesn't share an interest in or can't fix. And then you have an issue because, hold on, you're next. When, for example, most problems are solved by us diagnosing and patching the problem ourselves, or diagnose the problem and working with the open source community. Let's say, take Perl, for example. If we get core dumps in Perl, we aggressively analyze it in-house. You know, we've got debugging versions built. We gather as much information as we can, attempt to solve it and understand it ourselves. If that fails, then we go to the community, report the bug, work with people to come up with a solution, and a lot of times we get a patch back in a timely fashion, and we solve most of our problems that way for a lot of the open source that we've managed. The problem is, when the model fails, what do you do? Okay, well, you can, with a corporate vendor, you go and you yell and scream. You know, you have meetings between my boss's boss and your support guy's boss's boss, and we sit there and we look real mean at each other and we yell and scream and say, we've been trying to support us. and somehow that's going to make the code get fixed faster. I don't know how that works, but obviously that's what they believe works because that's how that works, right? We scream at you, bug gets fixed quicker. Yeah, we can scream at you and you won't pay attention to a bug you're ignoring. That is one thing that must be done. I guess the only reason to scream at people is to reprioritize problems sometimes. But for the most part, you can't do that in the open source community. It's negative input. If I scream at Perl 5 pointers to fix the core dump, the chances of it getting fixed will drop exponentially based on the tone of my rudeness in my mail. That doesn't work. Okay? So when you hit that barrier of what you do, take a couple different approaches. We've done for looking for specific consultants to fix it. Paying people to focus on the problem and trying to find a fix is one approach. We did go to buy support from Perl briefly. But in all honesty, we use it so rarely, we're paying for it. That model in general has worked. When you hit your... One of the keys to integrating open source and making part of the infrastructure would be building the skills you need to manage it. People in your IT shop have to know how to build, install, and support this stuff, the basics, you know. New release comes out. How do I get it in there next to the old one, or how do I migrate? They got to know the fundamentals about building and installing the software. You don't expect these people to know the internal deal to fix all the problems, though. If you build that minimal skill set to do those first two levels of support, you may not find that you need commercial support. And for SoftBank Morgan Stanley, that's true for, I wouldn't say most, but a lot of the open source we have. I'm not sure I can quantify that anymore because you buy so many big products now that are based on open source. If you don't have that skill set and you can't provide that support, then you need to manage that risk by going and buying support from someone who will provide that for you. And you need to make that decision. If you are finding that your internal guys are failing to support the product, you better go contract with someone to do it for you. And I think that's really the key to being successful at that. You need to understand the limits of your own IT shop, what they can and can't do, and be careful that you don't overburden them. Oh, yeah, it's just open source. Fine, build and install it. Well, until it starts core dumping on a regular basis and that mission-critical thing you put on it stops working, everything is great. What do you do when things break? I think one of the most important things that I try to apply to any architecture design someone brings to me would be to make sure that they had planned on every component failing. Don't assume that you can have 100% uptime for anything, any building block you have. You've got to assume not if, but when. And if you don't make that assumption and design around it, then you have a flawed design. And the same thing can be applied to building an IT organization. If you don't figure out that I've got the resources to support even product, then you better go out and find a commercial company or you're going to be in big trouble. So it's a solvable problem these days, but you have to understand whether or not you've got those resources. Any questions? One more hands? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Keep going. One of the points you made about the more specialization and the more higher level, I think you said, the more likely it's going to be trying through software.
Yes, what I said, I will say again, what the point was, I believe that the lower you are in the so-called protocol stack, lower the core, the network and the core operating system, the more likely it is that open source solutions exist and are there to solve your problem. The higher you get up in the stack, you're talking about more specialized business applications, specialized to different regions, to very, very different, to different people. The more you get specialized like that, now it makes sense for a proprietary software to perhaps be the right business model. I'm not ruling it out categorically.
No,
that's not important. So based on that...
Right. So we should have open source cabling, right? Fully dominate the physical
web?
No, I'm just kidding.
Okay. Well, what you do, you have open standards for all of that, and that's why there's no point in anyone selling a proprietary, category 5 cable.
There was a kind of use, and I sent you the Gmail link, but there was a huge kind of vicious debate about...
Oh, that debate, yeah. I wasn't all impressed.
My grandfather's pacemaker would be proprietary open.
Yeah, there were some people that totally didn't get it there.
I know. A little movie, but...
I won't name them.
Anyway, it seems to me that, obviously the benefits of a large community of developers are contributing and dealing with bugs and so on. Obviously, if you don't have it, it's a problem and it's a weakness. It's really feel more, open source software, in a specific role. On the other hand, I still fail to see why proprietary applications that specialize higher in the OSI model would be better.
I didn't say it was better. Did I say that? I didn't mean it was better. There's a market for it, and that's where it makes sense as a business to look at maybe buying a proprietary solution for something specialized, rather than acquiring that special skill set to build it myself. Okay, but it does make sense for a big Morgan Stanley to have, you know, networking experts and Linux gurus and guys that can hack in Perl and all these little languages to build, to work on building an infrastructure, core infrastructure of open source software. But it doesn't make sense for you to buy, necessarily get people to do it. It doesn't, that's what I'm trying to say. It doesn't necessarily make sense that reverse that sense. To put this right, it's not that proprietary software is better in that space, okay? It's just that there's a logical market for it. Because unless I'm a huge IT shop, I can't afford to have all those specialized skills for all those specialized problem sets. Okay, I'd rather go out and buy some software that from someone. That's what I think is a logical market for it. As those things scale and become more commoditized and more commonized, then open source starts to become more viable.
Sort of riffing off of that, you know, when you began this whole discussion, you made not an assumption, but you sort of guesstimated that most people here write code.
Is that true?
I don't know.
How many people here don't write code for a living? Don't be shy. It's okay. We won't do anything new to you. Okay.
How many people here don't write code for a living?
Well, actually, right now, I don't know anything about this.
Well, I have to be one of the 20 head bosses. Okay, but I've been working in open source for a really long time. So,
we did that.
I used to work for VM Linux, so I sort of get off. And in any event, you're bringing up a very good point. I work for a small enterprise, about 550 users, 43 servers in production. It's New York is kind of hard. And
nice place.
But there's a lot of interesting niche specialized areas where I'm on that ordinary dilemma of build versus buy. It gets even more challenging when you're not a large enterprise because there's no commercial product to ease your pain at the space where you want to buy it. You know, like if we have an education department, we have to register students. But we don't need a registration program that NYU uses for $1 million.
Yeah, but that's an example. Okay, the student registration is an example, kind of like CRM software, where you know it's a common enough problem that I wouldn't be surprised if an open source solution, you know, if it doesn't exist today, would make sense.
You know, we use a hugely expensive commercial application for our library.
I think you'd be surprised if you really do the hunting how much open source has sprung up in niches like this to compete with a lot of those proprietary options. I mean, this is an extra reason why when you have limited resources for development, you would want to focus them for your own internal development on those problems that are special to you and not waste a lot of time on the core infrastructure stuff. I mean, do you really need to go write your own network monitoring code, or can you go buy, you know, get some open source software that does that for you? Buy support for it. That's the most cost effective at the lower level. If you've got to go buy some proprietary, make sure that the proprietary code you're investing in is stuff that is for the specialized problems and not the core infrastructure problems. That's, like, I guess, a better way of putting it.
Right.
Yeah.
Actually, getting back to what you were saying, speaking of libraries, definitely working with for a while. And one of the things that the libraries did do because they did need specialized software and they were broke was that they would form alliances amongst, you know, I need a package to keep track of books. You know, well, if I can get, like, say, all the libraries on Long Island each put in, say, $3,000 a year, now I have, you know, $100,000 to hire a developer.
I think that's how the CRM stuff, to a certain degree, got started. A lot of companies got fed up with these big, bloated, expensive proprietary packages they were buying, and they kind of got fed up with it, and they funded something. And that's the users. And this, there's nothing stopping any arbitrary user group in any industry, you know, healthcare, whatever, from stepping up and doing this. There are enough talented people out there who want to write code that you can find the developers to do this. We have no shortage of people, whether they're good code or not, it's going to pop. Let's cut everyone some slack. It's a good thing that there's a lot of people out there who want to write code. There's a lot of resources you can draw on to get people to do this kind of work. And so something can be funded, and the cost can be shared across, you know, several different companies to get something
succeeded. The
traditional hacker open source thing is kind of an anachronism anyway. It's just sort of
doing it as, for want of a better word, like as presented as a hobby.
Okay.
Like it's fun enough.
I think there's very few products that have the history of Linux, starting from a guy in his underwear in the Swedish closet, going to enterprise code. That's a great fairy tale, and it's a real cool story, but I think that's the exception, not the rule.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of code started off as a company that was hacking, and then it's cool, throw the wall, hey, that kind of like it, audience. And the next thing you know, it's grown to some beast beyond proportion. But in general, an awful, well, yeah, to a certain degree. Well, Pearl started out as Larry Wall wanting to do something really sick with RM.
Yep.
And he did. Anyway, let's talk about history for all. I think that the model we talked about where a bunch of businesses go to seed a foundation, people find some smart people to keep the organization going and create a new product like that will be the model that you'll see more and more of these enterprise apps starting off. The days of the, I'll write it in my closet and in 5 years we'll be running the world, like, yeah, okay, there'll be a few interesting stories like that, but the bulk of software is not going to follow that path. We Morgan Stanley got so fed up with MQ, we talked to several different times to some of our other business partners about perhaps seeding a group that would write an open source competitor to that product. It never went anywhere. But that's an example of where, you know, the frustration with the commercial product and its expense led us to look for an alternative. There isn't one. All right, well, we're willing maybe to take the financial risk and get something going because we see the clear benefit of freeing ourselves from this headache and these license fees. I think that'll be more prevalent. Well, there's a product now, this company in Israel, and it's really cool. Well, it's namely Java, it's JMS, but are you familiar with it? I forget the name. Smart Man. Yeah, he left his feet behind too. He almost lost his sanity along with me. We almost went crazy together. I forget the product name, but it's a product that's targeting the same functionality as MQ Series. It's entirely open source. And their initial product is the entire JMS API, and they do some pretty cool things. And their goal is to eventually be, you know, wire compatible with MQ, so that they get into that space. And I think these guys, looking at what I know about how widely deployed MQ Series is and how much it's loved by all the people that use it, I think they have a huge potential market. That is in itself a market. If you can identify, you know, a proprietary product in a particular problem space that does not have open source competition, okay, or any competition for that matter, and you can find a disgruntled user base, that's a huge potential capital source to get, you know, something started. And I think that's the kind of the way that more and more products will be coming about. People will see if they're stuck in this proprietary hell with this particular product, and they'll go, well, we want to play the open source game too. And if you don't have the developers to do it, maybe you've got money in your pocket to work with some other people and form a consortium and make it happen. I think that's going to be a model we see used more and more as the corporate world starts to realize that this is the right model to use for developing this software. Not for the people that, you know, write the setup, but for the people that use it. And when as more and more realize that, we're going to see more and more investment in open source. It's a positive feedback that I think will just continue. Anyone else? I have my mind wrapped, but are we out of time? Ask me anything. You want to know what this means? I'm like that too. Yes?
What are your thoughts on both MPI and Sun moving to Linux?
SGI and Sun realizing that they've lost and they had better get their asses on the Linux bandwagon or they're not going to have a Unix offering eventually. Sun probably had the best situation of all. SGI still is selling Iris on their graphics workstations. They haven't gotten rid of it completely, and I think that's because they got so much invested in all that graphics software and everything else they did that getting it all onto Linux is not an overnight, you know, port code, you know, type make install, you're done. There's a lot to do there. Plus, they've got an installed user base, and it's not going to jump overnight. So, I think that they've recognized that the writing's on the wall, that they better get on the Linux bandwagon eventually, and off their proprietary, you know, Unix kernel, or it's going to impact their bottom line really drastically. So, they're doing the right thing, I think.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see the FBI with how they, taking RAM and turning it into a kind of product.
Well, okay, the interesting thing is, will Sun and SGI take all their cool things they did to Unix and give them back to the community? Now, Sun's essentially done that with Open Solaris, but now it remains to be seen if the Linux folks will look over the wall and go, ah, that's cool, and they'll get some cool things out of Solaris and put them into Linux. That's what I hope happens, and I hope that happens with SGI, too. I would not be terribly shocked if SGI went, okay, fine, here's open Iris, and did the same thing eventually. But again, you're going to have it's an internal battle they have to wage between, you know, people on both sides with proverbial, you know, IP fence, intellectual property fence. And I don't know what I can't predict what they'll do, but the fact that they have 1 foot in the Linux world, every Unix vendor has 1 foot in the Linux world. I think it's just a matter of waiting, trying to figure out the right time to pull the other one out and get completely in it. That we'll find out over the next few years. I think it'll take a while. I mean, there's too many people with installed bases of Solaris on Linux running production who do not move as quick as some of us do, and who are going to be stuck running it for years. And as long as those shops are all running it and demanding support, code will live on. So it's not an overnight transition. I mean, it's a many year change that's going to happen. This will go away. It's inevitable.
One of the questions I have is just about the GPL and finance firms. I've worked on office finance for a long time. I met two people from General Dynamics Canada at BSD Camp, and they were horrified about GPL. The GPL was like the scariest thing in the world for them. The idea
they swallowed the fun. They swallowed the fun. Keep going.
Basically, is there any concern about GPL?
Well, okay. We do make our software available to third parties. Okay? And so there's a real risk there. In fact, we have been extorted by a software company that I promised legal I would never talk about. They extorted us. They were stupid. In the end, they got exactly what we were about to pay them for support anyway, and just made themselves bitter non grata that we had no respect for. And that was stupid. So there are some real risks. I mean, I wish I could tell that story, and it pisses me off that they won't let me, because it's a real example of it. Look, most open source companies and most open source developers are, I don't want to say altruistic, but for the most part, their interests in the software are in, you know, making the software better, see more people use it. However, there are those out there among the business world who just simply look at laws as tools. That's what they call it, a lawyer, like a sawyer, same thing. Law is a tool. It's a means to an end. If you can figure out a way to sort of map this ridiculous illogical sentence through this one to this one to reach this conclusion that makes absolutely no sense and it can make you money, they'll do it. And that's essentially what they were doing. They're playing word games with us, trying to squeeze money out of us. And it was pissed us off because we came to them to pay them money for the support. And they turned and said, hey, let's see what we can suck out of them. What did they get? They got exactly the same number from us that we were about to pay them for supporting them. And lost all our respect. And that was unfortunate because it was a product that's pretty good. It's me, like, wish I could say it.
So you say, you know, if it's a third party, if you guys were, I don't know, if you go to clearing, if you did clearing, you had to close some back end stuff at a third party, you wouldn't exclude GPL software.
Not necessarily. Depends.
What if people just say, man, it's a GPL? Like, what people don't practice, and, you know, it's hard to knock on the door.
No, we have no defense. We make sure that anything we include stuff we don't mind sharing. Okay.
Yeah, and all the proprietary stuff we care about is going to be on our servers, inside the firewalls. We give you something, it's just going to be a little, you know, the punch of a hole to get the data in through it. There's nothing really interesting on the other side over there. The protocols that you talk to us are going to be all standard protocols, TCP/IP, over the web, whatever. Nothing sexy there. The interesting stuff, we keep safe inside. So, if you're a some company selling software, that's really, I think, the more interesting problem. That's when you got companies like Black Duck Software who sell services and software for the purpose of making sure that your software doesn't have any, you know, GPL code in there. You don't know what some moron hacker did who's got, you know, CVS commission on your tree, who's going to have the code. So, I can solve that problem. I'll just go steal this code over here and plug it in. How do you manage that? That's a whole market that's popped up, right? In the Morgan Stanley case, that's not as much of an issue because we don't sell software. The concern we have about the GPL would be to make sure, or not the GPL, but open source licenses in general, would be to make sure that if we're going to bring some code in, does it use a license that we say is okay? Which essentially right now means, does the OSI say it's okay, we probably say it's okay. But there's a lot of open source out there with its own, you know, Joe's license, which is not really the same as the others, you know, because some guys think, well, hey, I wrote the code, I'll write my own license too. And no, bad idea. If you do that, you are probably not going to get your code at our shop because you may not take the risk. Yeah.
If you feel free, or maybe something else, so I've thought about it, companies like Google.
No, you know, I don't care about licenses. No, that's somebody else's problem. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't really like lawyers. They make my life miserable. So they're ruining the world. So what, you know, it's just a problem space I don't really personally have any interest in. So, you know, I'll wait till the dust is settled and read what comes out of that. It's just a license. Code's more nasty. Anybody else? Yeah. I guess it's time for beer then. I guess we're done. Well, cool. I guess thank you all for having me. I enjoyed it. Well,
I guess, unfortunately, audio.